Capital Investment Committee will come to order. The first item on the agenda is the approval of minutes. Representative Juergens.
Madam Chair, I'd first like to move the approval of the minutes from February 11th.
Okay. Sorry. The motion is accepted. Is there any corrections or additions? If not, all in favor of approving minutes of April 11th, April 11th, 2019, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted as printed. Representative Bennett.
Madam Chair, I move, is it February 11th, Madam Chair? Which one?
Yep.
Yep, I move the February 11th minutes.
All right. Any additions or corrections to February 11th minutes? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 The February 11th minutes are adopted as printed. Representative Juergens?
Madam Chair, I would move the minutes from the, what do we have left here? We have February 13th, 2020.
All right. Are there any additions and corrections to the February 13th minutes as printed? If not, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The minutes are adopted. First item on the agenda today is the governor's bonding recommendations for the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Thank you for coming, Commissioner. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Murphy, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Grove. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Thank you for having me here today. It's my honor to get to walk you through the governor's budget plans for bonding for our department for this session. We have four major priorities for this capital budget session, and they are as follows. The Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program for an amount of $9 million. The Innovative Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program for $3 million, the Transportation Economic Development Infrastructure Program for $3 million, and the South Minneapolis Career Force Location Asset Preservation for $642,000. The first three are competitive grant programs designed to help cities and counties provide the necessary infrastructure for a specific economic development project. And the last is a very specific ask we have for an asset that we own as a state that I'll get into in a little bit. So I'll walk through each of these, and I look forward to taking your questions. The first ask is for the Business Development Public Infrastructure Grant Program. That's a mouthful, so we'll just say BDPI from now on. I think you're all pretty familiar with the program. This is a phenomenal program the legislature has created to help cities and counties outside of the seven-county metro. So this is a greater Minnesota program, provide the infrastructure they need to undertake an economic development project. Think wastewater, think drinking water, think storm sewers, utility extensions, roads. That sort of thing. The program works as follows. It is a matching grant with local governments, up to 50% of those public infrastructure costs. It's not to exceed $2 million in any given year. And again, it is just for outside of the seven county metro. To give you a sense of a project to make this come alive a little bit more, let's look to the city of Lakefield. They got an award of $219,600 to help Husong Manufacturing, broadly known as Cozy Heat, improve some municipal electrical lines near their factory. This is a company that makes electric and gas fireplaces, and they had some overhead lines that were providing power to the facility that were getting knocked down in ice storms, and in order to expand their facility and keep those lines safe, they needed that funding. In addition to that funding, they put in money of their own, even exceeding the 50% match, and this led to the creation of 40 new jobs in Lakefield. So these are very specific programs for which public infrastructure need is there to help an expansion grow and ultimately create more jobs, which is what all these grant programs are all about. If you look at sort of the history of some of this funding, I won't get too into the details on the numbers here unless we want to dive deeper, which I'm happy to. The program has been funded by both bonding dollars and general fund dollars over the years. It has had in its appropriations previously anywhere from $4 million to $10 million, actually $12 million in general bonding funds. Again, our ask here is nine. Very popular program. The pipeline is full of great projects, and we're eager to replenish the funds so we can help more Minnesota cities grow and thrive. The next program is the innovative, Chair Murphy, yes.
That program and your other programs, are they all run the same? I mean, do you let out the money all at once, or do you let money out in pieces, or what? I noticed in a couple things you still have some money
mm-hmm.
to award. Could you explain how that works?
Sure. Chair Murphy, members of the committee, the funding is on a rolling basis. We usually do it in usually the 3 or 6 month windows of time in which the grants are released. Most of the programs you see before you today are either at zero or on pace to be at zero for current funding. So, again, we take in projects, and as they're eligible, award the money. And there's some competition here between different projects to make sure we're giving the money to the best projects possible.
And can a city get more than one grant? At a time.
There are, I have to look by each program, there's caps for the amount of grants you can get. I believe you can get more than one grant. Steph, correct me, you can. Yeah, just depends on the project at any given moment.
Okay. Please proceed.
Great. Our next program to walk through is the IDPI, which is very similar to the previous program, although the word innovative is in it. And the reason for that is that the legislature wants to ensure, as does DEED, that we are providing funding to innovative businesses, which create more jobs on average than other businesses. And you may ask, well, what does innovation mean in this context? Well, the legislature was very specific about that. When they defined innovation, they said it included technology, manufacturing, warehousing and distribution, innovative business incubators, ag processing, or industrial office or research park development that will be used by any innovative business. So this program has a couple differences from the previous one. Again, that definition of innovation is key. It also includes a seven-county metro, so it's not just a Greater Minnesota program. And the funding model is a little bit different. But again, this is all going towards the same types of infrastructure we talked about before, which is wastewater, drinking systems, roads, bridges, et cetera. As I said, grants are again to local governments. The funding model is slightly different. We can get into that if it's interesting to folks. And again, it's a statewide program. To give you an example of this, City of Willmar has a business called Epitopics. They do incredible work on really groundbreaking research in the poultry industry. It's a biotech company. And they needed a new sewer system in order to expand. And the City of Willmar was awarded $1.3 million from this program. Again, they matched that money themselves. And this allowed this new sewer extension to service Epitopics. And that created 17 new well-paying biotech jobs in Willmar out at that really amazing MinWest campus. If you've been there before, it has a lot of great businesses there. And Epitopics has done so well. They've been acquired by a Dutch company and are growing more by the day. So these are the kinds of companies that are awarded IDPI funding, for which the state is happy to see grow outside the metro as well as here in the Twin Cities. So our funding ask here, as I mentioned again, is for $3 million. It's had a mixture in the past of general obligation bonds and general funds, and it's awarded on a rolling basis, just like the other program. Our third program area today to walk through is the Transportation Economic Development Infrastructure Grant Program, or TEDI, one of the cuter acronyms in state government. This is a partnership with the Department of Transportation and DEED. Again, $3 million is the ask, and this is all about transportation. This is to ensure that grant improvements to a specific economic development project will allow for easier access to transportation. That could be land acquisition, that could be construction, it could be reconstruction. Any transportation-oriented infrastructure improvement falls under this grant program. It's competitive, again, it is statewide, so Metro and Greater Minnesota, again, for local governments and for that local infrastructure that's so critical. We do this in tight partnership with our friends at MnDOT. And just to give you an example of a project, we did some work up in Thief River Falls. They are home to a fantastic business there called DigiKey, for which there's a lot of freight coming in and out. Those semis were going through right downtown Thief River Falls and really clogging up traffic, getting stuck at railway lines. And so these grant funds helped create a bypass outside of the downtown area for easier access to Thief River Falls for that freight. Increased transportation speeds significantly. Also helped Arctic Cat, not just DigiKey. And with that speed and those efficiency improvements, the expansion that Thief River Falls DigiKey was able to undergo created 500 new jobs and retained about 4,000. So very popular program. You know, think extra exit off of the freeway, better road, better access road. These are the kinds of things you end up seeing in the Teddy program. And again, pipeline's really full. It's currently at a zero balance, so we've put that money to good use and are excited to ask for more. A bit more on the funding background here. Again, we can go into some of the detail there if you'd like to see how we arrived at these numbers. Before I wrap up, I want to walk through our final ask. It's a little bit different. Chair Murphy.
Sam Torkelson has a question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being with us this morning. You were talking about the TED program, and you highlighted a rural project that was funded by TED. But if we look at the history of the TED program, rural Minnesota has been shortchanged. Most of those projects have been awarded in the metro area. I know it's not your fault. The Department of Transportation does that work, and I've indicated to them my frustration with that particular program, and they have they are working on it to make it a more balanced program. But I just wanted to make sure that that particular aspect of that program was highlighted. And I call it TED, not Teddy. Teddy just, I don't know, it just doesn't sound right.
Madam Chair, Representative Torkelson, agreed. Teddy is a unique acronym. We'll either like it or not. But I'll say this. There's actually two different programs that MnDOT runs as it relates to infrastructure improvements here. Teddy is unique to DEED. You may be thinking of TED. I'm not sure. TED is, I think, the name of the program that MnDOT runs. So it's a different ask than we're making here. You'll hear, I'm sure, from Commissioner Kelleher in the future. But for now, we're talking about a DEED-specific program for which there is a lot of
Teddy.
We're Teddy. We're a little cuter at Deed, I guess, than our
Madam,
friends at
Madam
MnDOT.
Chair, my bad. Or perhaps it's my baddie. I don't know.
Okay.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. Just a little bit of a shot in the dark here. Do you, Thief River Falls also has an airport request. Do you do runways? Is that transportation?
Madam Chair, Representative Erdahl, are runways included in the program? They are not. Generally, airport infrastructure grant programs have their own direct appropriations. They're more significant, and you'll see those come from time to time, but airports are not included in the Teddy program.
Right. Thank you.
How about freight at the airport?
Well, let's see. Would freight?
I think it's a no shake, but I.
Yeah, I'm trying to get into the specifics here. We don't see that. I don't think it is something that's usually included. Generally, again, this is a city cost with a private business that's there and expanding. So, this is primarily I think the DigiKey example is a very good example of the typical kinds of programs that we're funding here. It's a specific private business with a unique transportation need that we dive into.
Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The final ask for today is a very specific ask. So, again, the first three were competitive grant programs. This last ask is for the South Minneapolis Career Force location, which is in South Minneapolis, obviously. And the ask here is $642,000 for some capital improvements. The state, as I'm sure you all know, because they are in your districts across Minnesota, has many career force centers. These are physical locations where job seekers can come and get assistance to help find a job. And many of these, in fact, almost all these locations, DEED leases out in partnership with several other workforce partners. In this specific case, we do own a career force center in South Minneapolis. Happens to be one of our most heavily trafficked career force centers. 7,000 people a year come into it, extremely diverse clientele. It's a big building. If you've driven through South Minneapolis before, you've probably seen it before, the big logo up top. It has a significant number of safety code issues. We're out of compliance on some energy conservation issues, and there's some other kind of priority repairs that we're concerned about. And so the ask here is for $642,000 in bonding dollars to help upgrade the facility to get it into good shape. If you look at some of these pictures here, we're talking about HVAC. Lighting, some roof improvements. There's some work needed to resurface the parking lot outside. LED lighting inside is in need of repair. And so, we want to fix those fixtures. The exterior building and parking improvements need to be there, some weather stripping and caulking work. We just need to take good care of this facility that we own and make it a great place for people to come and find a job when they need to. So these are critical improvements to be in line with local and city codes. And the amount total there, again, is $642,000. So again, in summary, three competitive grant programs we're asking for funding, and then a specific capital request for a building in South Minneapolis.
Representative Grosso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I'm going to take you back to northern Minnesota again, because there's a couple more industries that are up in the furthest north parts of the state as well that are needing some better access to them. You've got Polaris, and then you've got the pharmaceutical over in Baudette. So those are some things. That are those any of those areas on the radar as far as getting some help?
Chair Murphy, Representative Grosso, I don't know, I'm not aware of specific applications in our pipeline for those projects, but so long as they need public infrastructure in order to thrive, then they're eligible. And we would love to work with you and your team to make sure that local business owners and cities in Baudette and what was the other city?
Over Roseau.
Roseau, okay. Are aware of the program, and we can help walk them through it.
Yeah. Commissioner, go back to the IBDPI innovative grants. Do you see any differences in the applicants, in the makeup of the applicants for those grants? Are they younger, or are they more less business-oriented, or what kind of people are attracted to innovation kind of stuff?
Chair Murphy, great question. I think the legislature designated a separate program because there's different types of business for whom this program is attractive. And, you know, whether or not they're younger or older, I'm not sure, but I would say that generally these are businesses using new technology and heavily invested in research and development to make outsized improvements in their given field. And given that opportunity to really pop and hit a market trend and really grow quickly, we would classify them as innovative. And it could be technology, it could be biotechnology, it could just be a new way of doing things. Innovation is one of those words that people define in a lot of different ways. But I think the legislature has given us these key sectors of biotech and manufacturing and so on that I mentioned earlier as a lens for the department to make sure we're directing these dollars in the right way. And, you know, when we research this indeed more broadly and look at how we put the state's money to use for growth, we want to be awarding businesses like these more often than not, and not just because they might seem new or interesting, but because they create more jobs. These are the kinds of businesses that the research will show create more jobs, not just in their individual firms, but adjacent jobs around them, which is really what our department's all about, which is creating jobs. So they're unique programs for a good reason, I think.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, can you tell us how you came up with the number for the IBDPI since it has statewide impact compared to BDPI, which you're requesting for more dollars? And so I just wanted to hear how did you come to that number?
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, great question. So just to give you a little bit of a sense of past appropriations for that program, in 2010 we had $4 million in bonds, 2011 $5 million in bonds, then there was a bit of a break, and then 2017 we had $1.158 million in bonds. Not sure why that was so specific. The ask from the governor's office at that time was $5 million, and then in 2018, the most recent bonding year was $2 million. We looked at application flows over time, the kinds of projects in the pipeline. We wanted to make that number as high as we could, given what we think will come in. In other words, we want to spend that thing down to zero no matter what. And so just looking at those historical trend lines, we're able to land on that number of three. We are confident we will get far more than $3 million in applications and that the money will be put to good use. We don't think about it necessarily as Greater Minnesota versus the metro as it relates to the amount there. We just look at the historical trend lines of applications to ensure that we have the right size program and the right size asked.
Representative Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so just a follow-up comment, I believe that if we are going to, you know, invest, and like you said, if there's going to be more requests coming in, I think that the agency should be requesting for a higher amount, because we know that there's diverse organizations out there that are going to be applying for these grants program. And, you know, I really encourage you to share some information with us with regards to how are you doing outreach to women-owned business, communities of colors, you know, veterans and people with disabilities too, so that we have a more broad picture of how these money are being used.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, it's a great question. I appreciate you encouraging us to do that. We will continue to and prize that highly. more broadly at our agency, we've undergone a pretty significant strategic transformation in the last year since we've spoken in this body, which is to make equity the job of every single program owner across the department. So every single owner of a program, including this one, has an equity goal as it relates to either outreach or applicant success, so that it's not just the folks who know about the program that end up applying. Whether that's the business up in Baudette or the woman-owned business here in the Twin Cities, we want everyone to know about these programs, have an equal playing field in which to compete for them, and that requires outreach. You don't just have a page on your website and point people to it. You got to get out into the community. So we do have some aggressive goals and outreach there, and I'd love to sit down at some point and walk you through how we're doing that. I appreciate the note here.
One final question that I have, Commissioner, is that your requests of the governor have been met. Is that correct? You didn't request $4 million when he's only recommending $3
million? Madam Chair, we are in lockstep with the governor's office on this, so the number isn't something that
but my question
we consult with him.
Were you lockstep with the governor before the governor's recommendations came out?
Yes, this represents Deed and the governor's lockstep recommendation on the amounts that we need. We're very much in agreement with the governor's office on that.
And you didn't request more funding than the funding that your present staff can distribute in the period of time that it's awarded for?
Chair Murphy, members of the committee, it's a great question, because that's the art and science of this, is figuring out that amount that you can put into the market effectively, and we are very confident that this ask can be put into the market effectively. All this work you see before you is not just something that I and a few people in a room put together. We worked with staff across the department to ensure our ask made sense and that we were able to deliver on it if we receive it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it. Board of Soil and Water Conservation, or Water and Soil Resources. I'm sorry, we're going to have to take 5 minutes off. No. Members, I have on your agendas, you have the time frames. And so that you can help keep those time frames so that we don't run into big problems like we did on the previous meeting. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm John Jasky, Executive Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources, and with me is
Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with Bowser.
Thank you, and we'll be happy to answer any of your questions either during or after the presentation that we have here today. So we'll get going. Just
proceed.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a little bit of background. Our agency is set up to deliver all of our programs, including both of these, largely through local governments. We utilize counties and soil water conservation districts, watershed districts, cities, even some townships, and collaborations of those organizations through joint powers organizations that they may have created as well. Our focus is on the private landscapes of Minnesota, and you can see that this landscape here shows that ownership of property in Minnesota, the yellow area is the private lands. All of our programs focus on the private lands. These are also in that same category, but of course they take a unique and different approach to delivering the results that each of these programs is set up for in statute, and both of them are statutory programs. So we will cover both of them. I will cover the first one and Angie will take the second one. So the first one is about the local road replacement program. This is a provision that is in statute, in Minnesota statutes, chapter 103G.222, and it is put in place to accomplish the wetland mitigation or the replacement of wetlands that are impacted by local government road authorities, counties, cities, and township road authorities that, you know, need to widen a road for safety or other reasons, need to, by federal and state law, accomplish that offset or that replacement in some form or fashion. They can do it themselves, but you know, over the years that was determined to be a less viable in terms of, you know, cost effectiveness, and less viable in terms of ecological benefit when the road authority was trying to do this right in their existing right of way. And so the state statute directed the agency to collect these small impacts. Typically they are small, and then consolidate that and do the mitigation and replacement in a location that made more sense, both for economic reasons as well as ecological reasons. It also meets the requirements of the federal laws that are in place, the Federal Clean Water Act, so it gives the Road Authority a much more streamlined mechanism to get their permits and permissions to do these road projects accomplished. What we have, of course, is a responsibility that in statute that needs to be, you know, backed up by the funding that comes from the state of Minnesota, and it has traditionally come from this bonding source. A little bit about, you know, how this works. You know, there's also, of course, private projects across the state and country that do the same sort of thing, and a development project for, you know, housing or for some other business development, they can use this wetland banking approach to offset those wetlands that are needing to be drained or filled through those projects. This program in Minnesota is much more cost effective because we do it through this consolidated approach, and you can see here on the left it indicates the costs on a per credit basis. And what people ask, what is a credit? Well, a credit is more or less an acre of restored wetland. There's some other small variables that are also important to that calculation, but that's the primary driver. You can see in Minnesota we also have a private wetland banking market that also has credits for sale, and in times gone by we've had to sometimes buy those existing credits because we were in a deficit or nearing a deficit in this program that we have for the local road authorities.
Excuse me, Mr. Daske, when you have to buy additional credits then for your wetlands replacement program, then where is the money from buying the additional credits come from?
Madam Chair and members, the last time we had to do that was in 2017, and it was a general fund appropriation to buy those existing credits. The bonding dollars can be used to go acquire and build an asset and keep it going, and of course we'll show you a couple examples of those. But if we have to buy these credits on the private market, we had to use general fund source for that acquisition. So where are we at right now? This is a map that shows the bank service areas, as they're called. They're really watershed areas, and these 10 watershed areas end up being the places where the wetland mitigation needs to occur if that's where the road authority impacted the wetland. Now, back to 2017, there was actually a small change made in the statute because we had road authorities in a position where they were going to have their projects stop because we didn't have any credits in these bank service areas. You can see today, you know, we have four of them that are in that same predicament where we don't have any credits available. And in a couple other places, we have a very small number. The statute was changed to allow us to move, you know, the replacement across these boundaries if we need to. But what happens when we do that is that the ratio goes up. So, you know, there's kind of a penalty, if you will, for going further away from the impacts. And so we need to establish these wetland mitigation sites, you know, across the entire state. And we've done that. But as you can see, we are entering a situation in the near future here where we're going to have, you know, no options in some of those bank service areas. And, of course, that'll deplete the other bank service areas more quickly. A little bit of history on the past asks and the past bills that have been passed. You know, all of our projections are based on the amount of wetlands that are, you know, are going to be impacted by road projects in a given year, and we project that based on the past. You know, the recent past is more predicting the future than anything else we can do, so we use the past. And somewhere between 170 or 200 acres a year is what we end up needing to accomplish, you know, on average. And so we just have simply ask for the amount that it will take to do that work. And in the past, we've seen, you know, the legislature hasn't past the amount that we asked for, and here we are now having to ask for a bigger number because of that. So it's a little bit of a catch-up year this time to make sure we have enough credits going forward. And this is shows that graphically. Obviously, you know, we're right at that margin right now with some of those bank service areas having no credits and a few others, you know, getting close to that. This graph kind of shows, of course, if you don't have any, you know, anticipated future revenue, where you're going to go. But you know, and bonding, of course, is not predictable. We have to come back and work with you each and every year, every other year at minimum to accomplish that. And so the local road authorities are concerned that we won't be able to meet their needs, and that'll mean that their projects will be delayed, or they'll have to do the mitigation on their own, which means even greater delay and cost. A The governor's recommendation is $26.4 million. And, you know, again, the point of this whole program, and it's in the statute, is to accomplish this wetland mitigation in a more cost-effective and a better ecological outcome for the public.
Mr. Jaski, what was the number that you recommended to the governor?
Madam Chair, it was the exact same numbers. These are the numbers that we published earlier this year.
Thank you.
And then this is just one example, and these projects are, you know, across the entire state. Here's an example of one in Murray County, which is in southwestern Minnesota, and you know, it's a piece of land that had been partially drained and you know, and not been turned into something that was otherwise real valuable, and so this site was restored. I think it's a couple 100-acre site with the grassland area around it, and this then allows us to use this site to offset those wetland mitigation opportunities or requirements, actually, that occur in that part of the state. And that, Madam Chair, members, is my part of the presentation.
Thank you. Ms. Kadelka.
Madam Chair, members, the second bonding request is the Minnesota CREP program, so the Minnesota Conservation Reserve and Enhancement Program. The program combines the federal CRP with the state RIM reserve, so the Federal Conservation Reserve Program with the state Reinvest in Minnesota easement program. It was passed in, the first legislation for this was passed in fiscal year 16 and 17, and the legislature has been funding this every biennium since. The program focuses in 54 counties, as you can see there on the map, in western and southwest Minnesota. And the Minnesota CREP is targeted in that it focuses in just on three practices. It focuses in on buffers, wetlands, and wellhead protections for drinking water. It's a perpetual easement program. It's completely voluntary, so landowners that are interested in the program sign up and go through a scoring to make sure that it is the most environmentally sensitive and critical acres. We've had two sign-up periods now. We had in the summer of 2018 was our first sign-up period. Then the summer of 2019 was our second sign-up period. We have 24,000 acres now enrolled in the program. Funding for the Minnesota CREP. So as I mentioned before, the legislature has been funding this to reach our goal of a state contribution of $175 million. What that does is unlock federal contributions that go directly to landowners of up to $350 million. There's four main funding sources: the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, LCCMR, the Clean Water Fund, Outdoor Heritage, so those two are the legacy funds, and then capital investment. So we are $16.5 million away from meeting the state's contribution for this program. Minnesota CREP applicants sign up for this program for a number of different reasons. This is an applicant from Freeborn County who's interested in this both for habitat, and it made sense financially. The Minnesota CREP program also delivers jobs and economic benefits. So, for example, when a landowner receives a payment for the easement and for the Conservation Reserve Program, so a federal payment and a state payment, there's also restoration involved. So restoration dollars go to hire local contractors, seeding to go and buy seed and plant and restore, whether it be a buffer or filter strip, a wetland, or for wellhead protection. And the benefits to Minnesotans are stacked, so there may be more than one. It keeps soil on the land where it needs to be for a productive ag economy. It can provide temporary water storage and protect vulnerable drinking water areas. Also, it enhances our grassland and wetland habitats, and finally sequesters carbon. And so again, that request was for $16.5 million.
Who's the fiscal agent for that?
Madam Chair and members, so the Board of Water and Soil Resources does the state contribution. The federal contribution goes through the Farm Service Agency, and that goes directly out to landowners.
And this request, this amount of money that you're requesting, then that is bondable?
Madam Chair, yes, this is bondable because it is a perpetual easement. So the ownership remains in private hands. So the landowner retains ownership of that land. The state then holds an easement on that land. And so that easement puts restrictions so that it could never be developed. Apartment building could never be built, or farming practices then on those critical landscapes would no longer occur. So the state holds the easement, the landowner retains private ownership.
Ms. Kadelka, House File 2529 did not have any bonding funding for PREP. And from the day that bill passed out of this committee and went to Ways and Means, where it sits now, I have not received any information of the importance of PREP to the bonding committee. Is there some explanation for that?
So, Madam Chair and members, so the bonding proposal has been one that, as we work with those four funding sources, the bonds have been used twice in the past. So it's been used $10 million each time. And the governor this time is recommending $16.5 million to come through bonding.
But I'm the chair of the bonding committee, and we passed a bill out of this committee last spring. And between last spring and now, now with the governor's recommendations, we didn't hear a thing about it. Is there an explanation of why we didn't hear anything about it?
Well, Madam Chair and members, we certainly would be glad to come back and chat more. We have shared this in front of the bonding committee in the past, but there may be, if there's more information that's needed, we'd be glad to come back and share again.
No. Thank you. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Chair Murphy. Just basically following up on her questions, did you make a request last year for PREP money for the bonding bill?
Madam Chair and members, PREP was not included last year. The agency has been working through a series of making sure that we don't ask for money before we would be able to use it, so that the resources are not being held up. And so we ask for the money in sequence of when the money becomes unlocked and available.
Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question about the local road and wetlands replacement program. If I understood it correctly, you said that when you have bonding, you go out and develop those wetlands. Mm-hmm. But when you don't have it, you just go out and purchase wetlands that exist. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative.
Mr. Jaskey.
Bonding money is how we go acquire and build these credits ourselves. If
right.
we get to a situation, a predicament, frankly, where we are not able to produce those credits because there's been a deficit of, you know, prior appropriations, then we're in a situation where we have to ask legislature for general fund dollars to go buy credits that are already built.
Representative Considine.
So these are wetlands that already exist. Oh.
Madam Chair and Representative. No, these are sites where we acquire an easement and restore a well and putting one back where one has been once before but does not exist now.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's where I was a little confused. It didn't seem like we were actually making a gain if you're buying something that was already existing.
Representative Jurgens.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Going back to the CREP request, is there a reason why you're opting for bonds versus LCCMR funding that you've received in the past? I guess I'm curious about that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Ms. Kodeka.
Madam Chair and Representative, so the legislature has determined that each of these four funds are ways to fund the Minnesota CREP program. Bonding has been one that has been available to this because it is a perpetual easement, and so the legislature has made those decisions in the past of funding and the governor recommending using bonds for this purpose.
as a Madam Chair.
Representative Juergens.
As a better alternative than the LCCMR, I guess I'm looking more for the why of why that seems to be a better option to borrow the money through bonding than using the LCCMR funding. I understand that it may be acceptable, but I guess I'm looking more for the why.
Ms. Kudelka.
Madam Chair and members, so I think there's different purposes. So for the resources, for example, water quality benefits can't be funded by Lisard Sam's Outdoor Heritage and vice versa, habitat benefits not by clean water. And so what the legislature has done in the past is has said that the LCCMR has gone towards both bringing in outreach and trying an understanding of the program, and so LCCMR has chosen to fund that part of it, as well as some of the easement programs. I guess the larger answer is that all four funds have been deemed as, by the legislature, has been deemed as appropriate for this funding source, and the LCCMR has certainly encouraged us to go and look in other places as well.
Mr. Jess.
Madam Chair, Representative, I also mentioned that as was mentioned before, you know, the legacy funds have a constitutional provision that requires that we, you know, not supplant, right? And so that is an important consideration because, as was mentioned, this program has been funded in some way, shape, or form going back to the statutory initiation in the late 1980s. And so we have to make sure we don't run into trouble with that constitutional provision, which is where the bulk of the funding has come from thus far.
Representative Grosso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Kudelka, I guess back to that CREP stuff. You talk about these perpetual easements. Let me understand that you're saying that, let's say, take farmland, for instance. You're taking good farmland out of production, and these farmers are still having to pay taxes on this. It remains in their possession, but they're having to continue to pay taxes on land that they can no longer have any production on.
Madam Chair.
Kudelka.
It's a hard one, Madam Chair. Madam Chair and Representative. So this is targeted to the most environmentally sensitive farmland. So this is oftentimes what farmers will refer to as their marginal land, and land that often is not getting good crop yields anyway, because it might be in those low depression areas right along the edges of riparian banks and streams and rivers. And so this is just for targeted towards those lands. This isn't the prime cropland area, because quite frankly, that is our best economic asset for our ag land. And we want to make sure that ag land is productive and able to keep crop production on it, as well as being able to make sure that the pollutants and phosphorus and nitrogen and sediment don't get into the state public waters.
Representative Grosso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would encourage you to get out and visit with a lot of these farmers. I'm getting a lot of complaints that low spots in fields are starting to be restricted from use. Just something that every spring has some water settled in it, or every heavy rainfall might have some water settled. It's not a waterway. It's not one of those areas that should have an easement around it, and yet they're being hamstrung and told that they can't do anything on those properties. A lot of the stuff that I've been learning from the farmers is how much care they put into what they use on the fields. A lot of their technology now shows them areas where certain things are needed, certain fertilizers, whatever, are needed, so they don't do an overall spraying of just these concentrated areas. So they're doing a lot of work to try to do the best they can to take care of the land that they live off of. Mm-hmm. Because if they don't take care of it, they don't make a living. Our nation doesn't eat.
That's right.
Neither does anybody else in the world. So to me, looking at some of these perpetual easements, you know, when you're taking people's land from them and saying you can't use it that they're paying taxes on, I think there's got to be a little more give there as far as what the state tries to push on them.
Director Jeske.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative. Just a couple of comments. I appreciate you, you know, offering us perspective. Again, just to remind everyone, this is a voluntary program. It's not something that landowners need to do. It's something they get to do if they choose to. And you're right, you know, that precision ag information that, that farmers are using today to generate better yields, more efficiency with their inputs, is also something that helps them understand which of their parts of their farm might be not productive. And that's what Ms. Becker-Kadelka was describing, is that it allows us to take those marginal lands that aren't yielding a profit to put those into a program that can help them, you know, find a way to make it useful, and also provide some public benefits. We're trying to achieve that balance. So thank you for those comments.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad you're bringing this forward. I think it's a good program. We're getting towards the end. You've used quite a bit of legacy money and LCCMR and then bonding. And I think it's a good program that we're, I think, it's actually something the state should be proud of, you know, working with the federal government and getting some help there. And so I think we're getting close to wrapping it up. And right, I mean, you're getting close to your total. And I remember when I was on Lessard Sams, some years you would take from Lessard Sams and then use those monies, just how you described to Representative Juergens. You'd move it around and we're strategic about it. But I think it's a good program, and it's actually very popular. So thank you for your effort.
Thank you very much for your insights that you have brought to this committee. We probably will have to have further discussion on your proposals and how it fits into the future. One of the things that we saw, or many of the things that we did see on our tours, our 17 days of touring, were projects and soil erosions, problems, and many climate change things that weren't even dreamed of 10 or 15 years ago. And so it is my hope that we are going to come together before the Easter break with a bill that is for the future. And just because past bonding committees considered something doesn't make it necessarily a fiat that we will consider it. But we have to have a bill that addresses all these issues for the future so we can go forth and not have to play catch up. And this proposal that you have brought before us certainly addresses that to a point. We appreciate your efforts.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Mr. Freeman, Public Facilities Authority. One of our very favorites, because it touches every part of the state in some way or another, and it has for many years, and because it is our hope for the cities to take care of important, important problems, or the townships, or whoever's around that has problems in the environment and with wastewater and with clean water and with growing populations and old aging pipes and old aging pipes that are being replaced or not being replaced. And oh my goodness, if new cities have to come about, they have to have systems. And you have the magic wand for all of them, don't you, Mr. Freeman?
Madam Chair, thanks for making several of my bullet points.
Didn't even read your thing yet.
There is no magic wand, but good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Jeff Freeman, the Executive Director of the Public Facilities Authority. We are the state agency that provides financing to cities for water, or wastewater and drinking water infrastructure projects. through several different grant and loan programs. The projects that we are funding are the general municipal water infrastructure that generally serve the city as a whole, as opposed to the deed programs that are more infrastructure targeted to specific development projects. And as you mentioned, Madam Chair, many of our projects often involve replacing aging infrastructure, old pipes, old treatment plants.
We saw them all.
So the PFA funding programs are designed to work together in a coordinated funding framework with low interest loans that are broadly available for all types of projects in cities of all sizes throughout the state. And then supplemental grant programs that are targeted to specific projects based on affordability and the need to upgrade treatment plants in some places to meet more stringent permit requirements. I don't have PowerPoint slides. I've got a handout that you should all have in your packet. The governor has recommended $200 million for PFA programs. That was our request. It is broken down in three parts. The first request is for $25 million to provide the required 20% state match to the federal capitalization grants that we receive for the state revolving loan programs. The Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Funds are the PFA's largest source of project funding. Last year, we awarded $195 million in low-interest loans to projects throughout the state. The $25 million request will match 2 years of estimated federal grants and help build future lending capacity to meet increasing demand. The second request is $100 million for the Water Infrastructure Funding, or WIF, grant program. WIF grants are based on affordability criteria that focus on cost per household for the wastewater or drinking water system, which means that the grants generally go to small communities because they have fewer users to share the costs of debt service and operation and maintenance of the system. WIF grants are packaged with PFA loans or can be used to co-fund projects with our federal partner, the USDA Rural Development Office, that funds water projects in small rural communities with similar grant and loan funds. The third request is $75 million for the Point Source Implementation Grant Program. The PSIG grants help cities upgrade water treatment facilities to reduce the discharge of specific pollutants to meet permit requirements and address specific water quality goals. Reducing phosphorus is the most common type of project, but there are other pollutants as well that are targeted. PSIG grants provide 80% of the eligible costs, up to $7 million. All of the PFA funding programs follow project priority lists from the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Health that rank projects based on age and condition of the existing infrastructure and water quality and public health criteria. Funding is not awarded until projects receive all necessary approvals and are ready to start construction. So if you turn to the green sheets in the packet, I can talk a little bit, and I'll cover this quickly and be happy to answer questions, but this shows the current clean water project priority list. These are mostly wastewater projects ranked 1 through 239 based on the MPCA criteria. MPCA prepared this list last summer at the beginning of fiscal 2020. And then they provided the list to us for and PFA for us to line up the estimated funding and the eligible funding for the different projects under the various loan and grant programs based on the statutes and rules of the programs. It's important to point out that this is a five-year list of projects in various stages. Some are just starting the planning process and maybe several years away from construction. Others are preparing for construction this summer. The gray shaded rows show that projects that have been funded since the beginning of the fiscal year and are now under construction. The shaded cells indicate funds that have been reserved in specific programs for projects that have reached certain approval milestones. I want to call your attention to column six, which says CWRF Clean Water Revolving Fund Loan 2020 IUP requested loans. The IUP is the intended use plan. That's our annual document that provides a list of projects that are eligible to apply for and receive loans each year. Projects with dollar amounts in these in this column have completed the planning process have submitted a request to PFA with a proposed project schedule to complete design work and receive approvals for construction this year. The PFA, we will award loans to all of the projects that have made those requests that complete the review and approval process. The column to the right of that, Clean Water, the CWRF Principal Forgiveness Grants, there's a small portion of the federal funds that we receive each year that can be used as essentially as grants either for affordability needs or to or for energy efficiency and other green infrastructure criteria. There are then several columns that show the WIF grant and PSIG grant programs, and I have some breakout sheets that I'll show in a minute that better explain how those programs work. To the right of that, there's a small community program that's not part of this request. That's a program for very small unsewered communities funded through Clean Water Legacy Fund. And then further to the right on the page, you can see USDA, our federal partners, projects that they've made commitments to, and a few other sources as well.
Now,
so then past the green sheets, the first white page past the green is the wastewater WIF program. So this is just a breakout of projects that were identified on the green sheets in one of the WIF columns. So these projects have been determined, or at least based on preliminary information, appear to meet the criteria for the WIF grants based on affordability. The programs or the projects are separated into three categories. The first is titled 2019 carryover projects. These have received all necessary technical approvals, USDA funding commitments by the end of last fiscal year, and are in the final stages of bidding and getting ready for construction. And some of them actually have now started construction, which is the gray shaded rows. You can see in the top right corner that at the start of the fiscal year, in this program, we had $33.6 million. And that amount, and then you can see a dotted line on that carryover list, that's how far that $33.6 million will reach. So all of the projects below that will require additional appropriations, and that's what we're here for with our request. The second category are new projects, new 2020 needs. They're just now submitting their formal loan applications to us for us to determine affordability needs. So these are our estimated grant amounts based on preliminary information, has not yet been confirmed. And there's also probably, and in fact, most likely, additional cities that will be determined as eligible this year as we get those loan applications from cities that have requested be put on the intended use plan that I mentioned. The bottom category and onto the next page identifies other potential needs. As I mentioned, the project priority list is a five-year list, so these are other projects that appear to be WIF eligible in for projects that will proceed in a future year. The next white sheet.
By future year, do you mean 221 or 222?
Well, they could come forward as early as FY21. That process of putting that list together will start this summer, or late spring, summer, and then we'll know which ones are lining up for 2021. And many of them will probably be in the years after that, but we'll find that out. The next page is the PSIG grant program, or the breakout sheet for the PSIG program. As I mentioned, this is the program that helps cities do the treatment plant upgrades to provide additional treatment to meet more stringent requirements. That's driven by a specific impaired water or a need to protect a particular water body. And so the pollutant or the permit requirements are more strict, and the cities need to upgrade the treatment plants to meet those requirements. It's broken down again in categories with carryover projects that have already met all of the technical approvals and are in the final stages of preparing to bid their projects. Many of these have already bid and are under construction. Again, the shaded rows. In this case, the top right corner indicates at the beginning of this fiscal year, we had $33.7 million available from prior bond appropriations, as well as $10 million that was appropriated last year from the Clean Water Legacy Fund. This program receives appropriations from both bonding and legacy. $43.7 million right now available, and the dotted line shows how far that money will reach. There's a few approved projects below that dotted line, and the way the legacy appropriation was done last year, it was $10 million was available in FY20, additional $8 million available for FY21, and that will actually be enough to fund those approved projects, Cocado, Two Harbors, Albertville. New applications below that will require additional appropriations. And you can see that that goes on to the second page with a number of projects that have applied. We will, again, there's a sort of a separate application process for this program. We will be taking applications again from cities in July, beginning of fiscal year 21. So there'll be additional projects added to this list, but this is the current list of applicants. Beyond that page is an alphabetical listing of all of the clean water projects on the list to help if you're looking for a particular city and where they fall on that priority on the green sheet. And then after that, the blue sheets are the drinking water projects ranked by the Department of Health based on their criteria, which again are based on age and condition as well as public health criteria. It's the similar kind of process. You can see the cities, the project descriptions, the rankings, the estimated costs, and then that 2020 IUP requested loans column 6 shows projects that have applied with a schedule to that they're working on final design, final other final approvals for this fiscal year, planning to be done with all of that by June of this year, and then ready for construction. Some of these have already gone to construction, as you can see the shaded rows all the way across.
And you can see the WIF grants there, as well as our USDA Rural Development partners. Some of those WIF grants, as I mentioned, go to match funding with USDA Rural Development. Past the blue sheets is the drinking water WIF list. Again, these WIF grants are based on affordability, and it's measured by the per household cost, both the operation and maintenance of the system, as well as paying debt service. And so because of that, it's typically the small communities that are eligible for WIF grants. And you can see both the carryover list, those that have already received approvals, as well as the new projects that we expect or are working towards approvals this fiscal year. In this case, the available funds of almost 9.4 million at the start of the year cover all of the carryover list and essentially down to the first project on the new list. As I mentioned, we don't actually fund projects or reserve money until they've received those approvals. So those projects in that 2020 needs category are working through that process right now. And then finally, a alphabetical listing of the drinking water projects. And Madam Chair, I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions.
Well, thank you very much for presenting these in color, because that helps a lot, and we'll use them going forth. So don't throw these away. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You're one of my favorite people too, Mr. Freeman. We're all scanning the sheets for our communities. But I have a particular question, and maybe I'll help other people just clarify too. The first white sheet after the series of green sheets on the WIF wastewater, am I to understand on that listing there, you have a little dotted line that goes across, and a community that I've been working with for several years, Deer River, is right above that dotted line. Am I to understand that those projects can be covered with reserve funds that you already have and do not need additional action from this committee or a body? Or
Madam Chair, Representative Lehman, the amounts shown there are are reserved from funds we already have. Yes, that is correct. Now, in the case of Deer River and many of these, they have not yet gone to bid. So the cost, the $3.7 million project cost and the $2.9 million of estimated WIF, that's based on estimates. The way the program statute works is we reserve money based on that estimate. And then they go out, when they've got all their approvals, then they go out and take bids, and bids often can come in higher, and that higher amount could trigger additional WIF need, which we then, if we had funds available, we would fund the additional need, but in this case, we don't have funds available. We're out of funds at that point, and that is the reason, actually, you see below the dotted line, Lakefield, White Lakes, to Lanesboro, mm-hmm. Those are projects where you'll also see those projects listed above the dotted line with certain amounts reserved. Those were reserved based on estimated amounts. The projects have now gone to bid. Well, Lakefield has not, but the other two have. Bids came in higher. They need additional WIF money, or they're eligible for additional WIF money, and they're below the line. It's going to require additional appropriation to do that.
All right. Thank you for that thorough answer. Thank you.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Director Freeman. As I'm going through these, of course, I'm seeing, you know, some cities repeated over and over again. Obviously, we have some cities that are struggling. But I'm also noticing that nearly all of these projects, sans a few of them, tend to be outside the metro area. Do you have any estimate on what percentage is outside the seven county metro area versus not? It's my cursory review says about 90% of these projects tend to be outside the metro area.
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, if you look at the green sheets, you will see a number of projects. I think they tend to start on page four, but they are scattered throughout the bottom of page four. MCES is the initials at the front end, and then there are a number of projects. That's Met Council Environmental Services. That's the Metropolitan Council's arm that runs the wastewater services for the entire metro area. We last fall closed on a $50 million loan to Met Council for, and the way we fund their projects is we do it on sort of an annual cash flow basis, a little different because the projects and the amounts are so big, but we made a loan of $50 million at just slightly above 1%, might have been 1.2 or 3. So they are a big part of the loan portfolio. Receive low interest loans that are better than they could receive with their own AAA bond rating, but they're not quite as low as the way our interest rate structure works. There are some additional discounts available for smaller communities. And so Met Council pays a little bit higher, or the larger borrowers such as Met Council, a little bit higher rate, but still a rate that provides significant savings for them and for the all of the metropolitan area users. And also by the fact that they're a large AAA rated entity, they help support our loan portfolio so that when PFA goes out to sell our revenue bonds, which we do from time to time to leverage additional funds, they provided significant strength to that loan portfolio, which helps our interest rate. So they're an important part of the overall process. They don't trigger the grants because again, the grants are based on per household costs, and there's just so many users. Now, individual cities in the metro area, and you'll see more on the drinking water list, there are some, but even on the wastewater side, metropolitan cities can apply for their own projects to replace aging sanitary sewer pipes, for example, and those can be ranked and are eligible for the loan funds. Probably in most cases, again, wouldn't trigger the WIF grants because even the smaller suburban cities in the metro area have significantly more users than most of the outstate communities, and that cost per user, they don't meet the affordability criteria there, but they certainly are eligible for low interest loans. And the loans that last year we made loans at just a little over 1%. This year it's gone up and down a little bit, but we're not much above that, and that does provide a significant savings to really to all cities in the state.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So the total amount of loans versus the total amount of grants, where do I find this on our spreadsheets?
I don't. So last year, I think on the front page, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Dean, the loans last year, total loans that we made were $195 million. The grants in total were about 80 million, as I recall, and I apologize, I don't have that on this sheet.
No, that's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Freeman, for the MCES, who is there, Mr. Freeman? Who gives out information about the metro cities that need assistance or where the problems come up?
Madam Chair, well, the Met Council does the treatment side. Lisa Thompson is the general manager of the Met Council Environmental Services. But then each individual city, as I mentioned, as far as their own sewer collection system that they are responsible for and could apply for, and that would be each individual city's public works people that would.
But the go-to person for Met Council as a whole is Mr. Thompson?
Madam Chair, yes, I'm sure there are. I mean, if I can certainly get a contact person for you if you would like to know more about how their funding or how they use these funds, we certainly could help arrange that contact.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, just to be clear for everybody, so the metro area really can't get grants. We send hundreds of millions of dollars out year after year to Greater Minnesota. We get the opportunity to pay more for the interest rate in the metro area for loans, and our loans prop up the giving of loans to Greater Minnesota. And that we're told constantly to apply to these things, these different grant things, but de facto, we will never get them. And it is not fair. It's not fair. And the administration said, you can apply for loans. We hear on the bus, you can apply for loans. We hear from our peers, you can apply for loans. But for the metro area, we will pay more, and we prop up your loans, and we can't get any grants.
Mr. Freeman?
Madam Chair, it's correct that the grants have gone and primarily go to Greater Minnesota communities, and that is, as I've said, because of the cost per household. If you look on the front sheet, under the WIF program, the second bullet down and in the middle there, it lays out the affordability criteria. Wastewater WIF, and this is in statute, 1.4% of median household income. Based on the current Greater Minnesota average income, which is about $60,000, as I recall, that would require a city to have per household costs of $67 a month to be eligible for the WIF grants. Now, lower income communities, that would be a lower number, but that's the average. In the metropolitan area, the last Met Council survey that I saw, they survey all of the cities in the metropolitan area and calculate what's the average metropolitan cost per household. As I recall, that number was $23 a month with the last survey. And so it simply is a matter of economy of scale. When small communities, the financial challenges are significantly greater in small communities.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Freeman, there's a difference between the average metro and individual communities payments in the metro. I think in West St. Paul, we had testimony last year that it was like $75 a month for wastewater. So an average for the metro includes well-off communities and poorer communities, and there's a great diversity in the price per per household within those communities, but they're lumped together for these purposes and therefore aren't eligible.
Representative Sandstedt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Freeman, you may have already said this, but hypothetically, if the governor's request was fully funded, how far down the list would we get?
Mr. Freeman.
Madam Chair, Representative Sandstedt, I can't answer that specifically because I don't know. You've seen the list with the potential new projects that are there, but before they could be funded, they have to have a project ready for construction, and they do not. For the most part, those projects are not ready for construction yet, and we know from experience that there's delays and, you know, technical reasons, environmental reasons, city financial issues come up. There's a lot of reasons why project schedules might change, and so I can't tell you specifically. What I can say is the loan programs where we can set a cutoff line and be more certain about it, or it's more under our control because we have the ongoing revenues from past loans that support those funds. On the clean water program, 40 points on the PCA's priority list has been our cutoff for many years. We've consistently held that number, and so essentially what that means is any city that ranks with 40 points and above would be eligible for a loan, whether it's their project is this year, next year, hopefully 10 years from now. And many projects in greater Minnesota also only receive loans. So the loan program is the major engine that helps cities deal with these needs, and it's the 40-point line, and then we base our determination of WIF needs on that same 40-point cutoff. On the drinking water program, and it's a totally different scale, so the numbers are not comparable. 7 points on the health department's project priority list is our cutoff there, which again then sets the basis. So 40 points on the PCA's clean water scale, 40 points out of a maximum of roughly 100. So the top two-thirds to three-quarters of the needs can be addressed through the loan program and then potentially with some additional grant to help offset the loan. Drinking water, 7 points is probably the top score, I think, is 30-something, but many of the projects are lower than that. So it's, again, probably at least two-thirds of the drinking water needs. Cities with those needs, as they're planning their projects, as they're doing their asset management planning and capital improvement planning and identifying projects for future years, if they rank with that 7 point and above, they can have some confidence that loan funds would be available for them.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Freeman, for being with us today. I appreciate your work, as I think all of us here do. To the issue of fairness and how these funds are distributed, you know, there are many programs in this state, and I'll highlight education, where the metro area seems to need more and get more because it's more expensive to do some things in the metro area. So we have structured our system in such a way that we give more money to the metro area for some things like education and others. Here we have a situation where, for our small towns, it's extremely expensive on a per capita basis to deliver these services. So expensive that, in some cases, to try and meet these standards, we're virtually condemning these communities to go out of existence if we cannot afford to help them. And Mr. Freeman and his work at PFA
and what we've allowed him to do with these grants and loans has actually enabled these communities to survive. It's a matter of survival in some cases, or it's certainly a matter of affordability for people that are on the low-income side of the demographics. So I would strongly defend what we do and how we do it because we are meeting a real need. It's a different balance than we have in other areas of things we fund with state government, but in this case, it's much more expensive to deliver these services, these life-sustaining, very important services on a per capita basis in many of our small communities, and I applaud the way we've done it, and I applaud Mr. Freeman for the work he does.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Freeman, and to Representative Torkelson's point, I think this is one of those areas that we do begin to understand that there are some needs that are greater in some areas of how we budget here at the state of Minnesota. And that when you look at anything in isolation, you can always look and say, you know, there's an imbalance here. But I think when we look at these issues collectively, I think it becomes to have a different sort of view to it in that, yes, there are some needs in the metro area that tend to be greater, and there are some needs in greater Minnesota that are larger. And that's the nature of Minnesota. I mean, if you look at Minnesota's economy over some of the really hard times in this country, we've fared really well because we have a diverse economy. And I think you'd be hard-pressed to find people in the metro say that the rural parts of the state aren't critical to our state's economy. And I would hope we would have it the other way as well, that the success in rural parts of the state also depended on the metro area and the richness of, you know, our Fortune 500 companies. You know, I mean, when you consider the fact that we have several major sports franchises in a, you know, in an urban area the size of the metro area, there's no reason that that should be able to exist. But it does, and I think it exists because of many ways our larger corporations that made sure these were critical pieces to attract people to the area so that we had a great workforce. So when I raise the issue about, you know, a large portion of this seems to go to greater Minnesota, it wasn't to say that it shouldn't go to greater Minnesota. It was to point out that in certain areas we do have imbalances, and we need to recognize those. I think all of us as legislators need to recognize those, that, you know, there are different needs in different parts of the state, and it's real easy to look at any one of those in isolation and say, this is totally wrong. Why is this happening? So I just hope as we continue with creating a modified bonding bill as we move forward, that those are some of the things that we consider in shaping that bonding bill. So thank you, Mr. Freeman. I think that the work you guys do is incredibly important to many of our communities throughout the state. And thank you, Madam Chair, for giving me a couple minutes.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. We might still have some questions about some of our towns, but we will meet with you on that at a later time. Thank you. Representative Lehman moves that we reconsider the motion, the Bennett motion and the Juergens motion on the minutes of the 11th and the 13th. All in favor of reconsideration of the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Representative Lehman, you were present.
Yes, Madam Chair, I just happened to notice that my name was missing from the last two sets.
Well, we don't want that
minutes.
To happen. So, all in favor of adding the layman name to the those present at the minutes, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted for the 11th, or reconsidered and adopted for the 11th and the 13th as corrected. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. The next meeting will be at 6:30 Wednesday. 6:30 the 19th. P.M. and you will be on time. And we are going to consider the governor's recommendations for corrections, human services, MnDOT, administration, and education. Thank you for coming. This meeting is adjourned.